Straight into it. As you've heard from Rupert, we're already feeling the effects of current climate variability and extreme weather events, and the projections point very clearly to current climate change and climate change continuing, and to the fact that disruption to society, whether it's the economy, social circumstances or the environment, is likely to also continue. Adaptation, as far as we're concerned, is simply the process of through attempting to anticipate, plan and enable action in order to reduce the costs and damages that will come from that change, from the risks, and to take advantage of any opportunities that emerge as well. And again, to echo Rupert, we absolutely see in the temperate zone, and in the UK in particular, there being a lot of opportunities as well as risks to face. This is us, and my colleagues certainly cover a fine range of pertinent expertise and have international reputations. Our second annual report, which is what I want to focus on principally this evening, it covers obviously our two core objectives, our purposes in life, to advise on the risks and opportunities and to monitor progress in preparing for impacts. You can see here the three areas that we decided to focus on in particular in the second annual report, and I will try to give you a snapshot of some of the key findings. This is a ladder that we developed for our first report, and we looked at it critically and we listened to feedback from it. We decided it is still very useful, so we're continuing to use this ladder and to evolve it as we go along. Where the committee has decided to act, I think, slightly in contrast to some other people looking at adaptation, certainly internationally, is we're trying very hard to focus on the top rungs, the top part of this ladder. We're trying to explore these and see whether it is possible to develop meaningful sets of indicators against them. This is in no way to suggest that the decision-making processes or capacity building, where most activity has gone on so far in adaptation, are not important, and indeed we're doing this as well. I think it probably comes as no surprise to anybody to understand why there's been a focus on decision-making processes and capacity building. It's because of the uncertainty surrounding climate change itself, and of course, the very context-specific nature of appropriate adaptation action, both through time and space. That given that, looking at outcomes is very hard, but we want to explore whether that is possible in terms of realised impacts, and we want to see whether there are indicators there and whether that can be monitored through time. And failing that, certainly we think we can get into the vulnerability area in some measure of detail. To explain a little more, perhaps, to set that out, just take the example of overheating. There are climate drivers behind this issue. There are intermediate impacts in terms of the urban heat island effect. And, of course, then there are the realised impacts in terms of fatalities brought forward. But feeding in there, there are components of vulnerability which are socioeconomic driven and environmentally driven. Some of them are on the left are contextual. They're almost givens, the age structure of the population, and to some extent the degree of social deprivation and its location. Others are much more readily controllable, the extent of urban green space, for example, and the quality and condition of the housing stock. And if you look at all of those coloured boxes, we think it is worthwhile trying to put quantifiable indicators in each of those and see how far we can get. We're doing this for, and of course, the uptake of actions as well. Now, I think, as I say, I don't want to skate over the importance of the decision-making processes here because they are absolutely critical. It simply seems to the committee that we will inform decision-making processes more intelligently the clearer picture we have of the elements at the top of our ladder. The more accurately, the more descriptively we can get to grips with outcomes, vulnerability, and actions, that seems to us that will inform the quality of the decision-making process rather better. Where should adaptation start today? Ground Rupert has partly covered already. This was the very simple matrix that the committee used to assist it in making its decisions. Climate-sensitive decisions are simply those which are already sensitive to current climate, let alone what change happens in the future. The others, I think, are self-explanatory. I'll just flick the systemic consequences one at the end. Just give you a very obvious example. If flood risk is the issue, then what you do upstream by way of development and building in the floodplain can have big impacts downstream. So it isn't simply the localised impact of that development decision and flood risk. There can be systemic consequences as well. And from those, we derived the five areas which we believed were our priorities to look at. And over the next 3 years, we will be looking at each of these, partly in turn and partly in combination. Starting with the land use planning, and again, everybody has identified flood risk as one of the principal issues here. The National Reporting Powers reports that have come forward have brought that forward. I don't think it's any surprise that the CCRA will also identify that. Virtually everybody has spotted that flood risk is one of the biggest risks we have to contend with. So, unsurprisingly, in this report, we decided to take a first go at looking at this. And you start clearly with the location of development. These are national stats for England, fairly straightforward picture. Shows 12 to 16,000 new houses each year being built in high flood risk zones. That's flood risk zone 3. That's equivalent to something like 8 to 11% of all new residential development. Given that there's something of the order of 1.3 million houses in high flood risk zones, we're talking about adding to that by about 1% per annum. So you could say that in terms of the location of housing development, we are adding to potential vulnerability at a rate of about 1% per annum. And the scale, I think you would agree, is not insignificant. 1.3 million houses is 4.5, 4.6% of the total stock. We decided to look then underneath those headline statistics and get some feedback from some local areas. And these are the areas that we examined. We went to these 9 local authorities, selected in accordance from the steering group, which involved the local government group and the Environment Agency and various other experts on it. We selected 9 authorities which are likely to experience climate risks. But this wasn't a random sample, but it wasn't pre-selected against anything else. And what you can see, I hope, is that in eight of the 9 local authorities, development has increased in areas at risk of flood from coastal or river sources. And in 4 areas, the development in areas at flood and coastal flood risk has been at a greater rate than across the local authority area as a whole. In all 9 areas, development had increased in areas at risk from surface water flooding, and again in 5 of them at a higher rate than across the area as a whole. Location and development is clearly only one of the factors which is acting on flood risk, and there are other actions in parallel with location which will either ameliorate that flood risk or perhaps exacerbate it. One of these is how we manage surface water. And again, from an analysis in those 6 local authorities that we looked at, you can see that in all bar 1, the area of man-made surfaces had increased significantly. And the area of and man-made surfaces in this period of time, in the last decade, I should say, are very largely going to be impermeable. There are some excellent new developments in recent years in terms of permeable paving, but we did do some exploratory work, and it is highly likely that most of the man-made surfaces which have increased there will not be permeable. Similarly, the flip side is that there's been a decrease in natural areas in all of those local authorities, again leading to loss of permeable surfaces. So one way of ameliorating flood risk could have been to at least minimise the extent of additional impermeable surfaces and to minimise the loss of natural areas. That doesn't appear to have been the case in the cases we were able to look at. The next way of tackling flood risk is at building level, at individual property level. And here our examination, I think, really gave some quite encouraging results. So in the authorities looked at, and in the applications we were able to look at, 96% of them incorporated one flood risk measure. It's quite hard to say whether this package adds up to a satisfactory total, but it's certainly a lot of activity, which I think was very encouraging indeed. We looked for uptake of flood alleviation measures, flood protection measures in the existing building stock, and it was very hard to find evidence of that. So we tried a different approach. We used a cost curve where the cost-benefit ratio of an individual protection measure would be shown by the scale on the y-axis and the extent of the benefit on the x-axis. Just in summary, the headline take from this is that there would be a significant package of measures that could be introduced into existing building stock, which would be cost-effective if done, obviously, at new build stage, would be cost-effective as retrofit at in advance of a flood, and the package was between £500 and £2,500 a property. That's a societally cost-benefit or beneficial approach. It would also give individual household benefits. And I think it's quite interesting from this that if households delayed carrying out these measures until there had been a flood and did them simply as a repair measure, then the benefits were very much less. So that there was an economic case for taking such action before flood, before the flood occurs, which I guess is common sense, but I think it was worth reporting. And these flood measures are a very basic stuff. I mean, it's repointing the walls, the external walls, to a metre high, putting non-return valves in on the sewage system and so on. So there, on the property level measures, to summarise, there is quite a lot of uptake as far as we could see in new build. There was really rather little going on a retrofit, but there was a cost-effective package of measures which we believe ought to be promoted and taken up. And, of course, the last, and I guess what people would regard as the most secure defence against building in the floodplain would be community-scale flood defences. This graph simply demonstrates that there has been an encouraging increase in the expenditure on community-level flood defences over the last decade, and that the number of properties protected by new or improved defences has increased very substantially. What we were unable to get to, however, was whether the scale of flood defences, how commensurate it was with the totality of the existing risk and the increasing risk. And I think that in itself is quite interesting, that we found those that evidence, those statistics, rather difficult to get to. In fact, we couldn't. So bringing that together for flood risk, and going back to the point where I started, that we are trying to evolve indicators to help inform the process, I think we've come up with some quite interesting results. Potential vulnerability is increased, undoubtedly, by development in high flood risk areas. The vulnerability is further increased by, at the moment, the area of hard surfacing increasing and the green areas decreasing. Therefore, as far as we're concerned, the trend is a negative one. The red is the increase in vulnerability. On the other hand, there are property-level measures which in new build, which are going in the right direction, And clearly there is an increased provision of community scale flood defences, also going in the right direction. What we were unable to say, however, is what does this tell us about the overall preparedness for flood risk? And we cannot, we wouldn't pretend to be able to categorically answer that question. We're trying to evolve these indicators to get us and society closer to answering those questions. We think it's interesting, though, that there does not appear to be an explicit process, a transparent process, by which the increase in vulnerability or potential vulnerability is weighed up against the actions that are taken to get, if you like, the residual vulnerability. We accept and fully acknowledge that local authorities have got a very difficult set of trade-offs to make in locating new development, and in many places, development in the floodplain is almost inevitable and quite possibly rational. But in the absence of an explicit decision-making process, which sets the benefits of development, particularly the short-term developments, but also the long-term benefits, against the costs, and particularly the longer-term costs, and even asks the question as to who will bear those costs in the longer term, we're not sure that that is, in fact, we would suggest that is not a rational process at present, as far as it was possible for us to examine it. And we tried quite hard. So I think that raises a series of quite significant questions, but it doesn't conclude, I must repeat, that necessarily building in the floodplain is the wrong thing to do. We just think there isn't enough examination at present to ensure it's the right thing to do. Given time constraints, I will give you a very brief snapshot of our work on managing water resources. I think, again, the first headline point is definitely a positive one. The security of water resources has always been reasonably high in England, and it's improved over the last decade to the point where only 8% of resource zones were at risk of supply shortfalls in 2010. On the other hand, our water supply at present comes at an environmental cost. Measuring that environmental cost, even qualitatively, let alone quantitatively, is extremely difficult. And the Environment Agency is currently engaged, I believe it's in 10,000 investigations as to the impact of abstraction from water bodies, certainly many thousands of those. Some of them have already confirmed that over-abstraction is an issue, and it is very likely that many more will conclude the same. I'd say it's hard to get a precise picture, but we know that there is an environmental cost, and I think it's reasonable to deduce that that environmental cost is quite significant. Given what Rupert and everybody else has said about future weather patterns and climate, it is likely there will be increased pressure on supply. The increase in winter river flows, I think, are projected to be very much outweighed by the decrease in summer and late autumn river flows, which EA estimates could be in excess of 50%, whereas the increase in winter flows 10 to 15%. There will be less recharge it is projected that there will be less recharge to aquifers, and it is also projected that there will be some increases in demand. The increased demand is at this stage, I think, quite hard to quantify, and those attempts at quantification have come up with relatively modest figures so far. Nonetheless, the conclusion is that without further action on both the supply and demand side of the equation, there would be an increase in deficits in 2035. And of course, water companies have plans to deal with this. This isn't suggesting there's no action going on. We did find that the extent to which climate change was actively modelled into those plans was highly variable. And I think that is something that needs looking at further in the future. So we did a cost curve analysis here, and we simply looked at what would be the cost and benefits of very simple water efficiency measures in-house, and how could that affect the demand supply side of the equation? I think most commentators would agree that the simplest and least regrets place to start is on the demand side, although action will be needed on both, and indeed it's the case that water company plans do look and often start with the demand side. Our cost curve here demonstrated that you could introduce an economically beneficial package of measures which would bring household demand, sorry, individual demand, down to the order of 115 litres per person per day. And that would be societally beneficial and beneficial for the individual at end-of-life upgrade and, of course, in new build. And that 115 litres per person per day is substantially less than current water demand levels, and it's substantially less than those projected for the future. Water companies have plans, as I said, to tackle both sides of the equation. None of them, as far as we could make out, and we've dived into these in a reasonable measure of detail, none of these come near 115 litres. The best get to 120, 125. Some of those are still projected individual demand at 160 litres per person per day by 2035. So our conclusion here is that there is certainly more scope on the demand side of the equation as well as because the supply side. So to bring this together, categoric conclusions at this stage, no, and I don't think anybody would expect us to come forward with those. But I hope these three observations, which are at the heart of our report, I hope they really do steer a lot of future thinking. They will certainly form the basis of our future work, and we will start exploring all of these issues in even greater depth with respect to flood risk, because that has been identified as one of the biggest issues. There is evidence that vulnerability to climate risks is increasing. There are low regrets actions being taken, but there is scope, economically beneficial, cost-beneficial scope for more. And for me, perhaps the greatest, it isn't evident that long-term decisions are yet explicitly accounting for climate change and the risks, or indeed the opportunities that are likely to come along. Thank you very much indeed.